Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday the 17th of June, these are our main stories. The Vatican considers ordaining married men as priests to solve a recruitment crisis in the Amazon. Iran says it will break the nuclear deal within days, so is it now effectively over? And
we have very good health workers who are committed to their job, but we have a few rotten eggs, and we need to get these rotten eggs out of the basket.
A Ugandan minister speaks out as the BBC exposes the problem of essential medicines being stolen and sold by healthcare staff. Also in this podcast, the UN Secretary-General calls on the world to do more to prevent land from being degraded. But how feasible is this? And
I flew for the very first time. That was the most exciting moment ever. That was the best experience and it was very beautiful.
How a group of teenagers built their own plane and are now flying it across Africa. The Vatican is considering the unprecedented step of ordaining married priests in remote areas of the Amazon, where there's a shortage of clergy. The issue is due to be discussed by bishops from the region at a meeting scheduled for later this year. Our religion editor, Martin Bashir, told us more about this break with a very long-standing tradition.
This document outlines areas for discussion at the forthcoming synod in October. It refers to 9 countries: Brazil, Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, Venezuela, Guyana, Suriname, and French Guyana. And these nations comprise about 33 million people. And it says in this document that this region represents a pastoral and environmental challenge. But it's the scarcity of priests that the church could directly address. And so it's drafting this suggestion of the possibility of ordaining elderly married men who are respected in their communities. It refers in the document to proven men of character to deal with the shortage of priests and says they should be outstanding members of the local Catholic community with grown-up families. The document also called for some kind of, and I quote again, official ministry for women in the area, although on that issue there's no elaboration.
But there will be opposition to this idea.
Yes, I mean, we are talking about almost 1,000 years since the Catholic Church maintained male celibate priests. It's also the case that on occasions people think that Pope Francis is a progressive liberal reformer battling to change the church. You'll recall back in 2013 when he spoke about gay people being marginalised and he wanted them integrated into society. And he said, if a person is gay, who am I to judge? Some progressives immediately thought this was a sign of the Pope willing to change the church's doctrine. In fact, he subsequently confirmed that homosexuality was a sin. Well, in this case, this is a document for the basis of discussion. But on a flight back from Panama in January, at the beginning of this year, Pope Francis was asked, would you agree to the appointment of married priests? And he said, no, I am personally opposed to any such change. So this is the community and the Conference of Bishops raising the scarcity of priests in that region of the world and the Pope saying we must discuss the matter. But I think I have to tell you that this is not an indication that this is going to lead to any kind of apostolic exhortation and therefore a change to the Catholic Church's practice.
This is to solve a recruitment crisis specifically in these countries in the Amazon. But of course, the Amazon isn't the only place where fewer men are coming forward to be priests under current terms.
Absolutely. If you project into the next 30 years and think, for example, of Northern Europe and North America, they are confronting exactly the same demographic problem, the lack of vocations. And that's why if a change is made in the Amazon, what would stop bishops' conferences in other parts of the world facing a similar challenge of not asking for the same?
Martin Bashir, our religion editor. An important element of the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers in 2015 was Tehran's agreement to limit its production of enriched uranium, a material which can be used to produce a nuclear bomb. Ever since the United States pulled out of the nuclear deal last year, there have been intensive diplomatic efforts to save it. But today, the Iranians have made further noises suggesting that may not be possible. That's a senior nuclear energy official, Behrouz Kamelvandi, speaking a few hours before we came into the studio, saying that by the end of the month, Iran will be producing more enriched uranium than it's currently permitted to do. So is this the end of the nuclear deal with Iran? I put that question to Jonathan Marcus, our defence and diplomatic correspondent.
Not yet, but it's clearly on life support. I think what really matters about this statement, and in a way the Iranians have said very little more than they said back in early May when they announced this decision to break away from some of the limits of the agreement. What's changed, of course, since then is in the context. Since then, we've had two spates of attacks on oil tankers in the Gulf. Both sets of those attacks, the Americans and some of their allies, ascribe the blame firmly to Tehran. So some people worry that America and Iran are sort of on the brink of some kind of a shooting war. And so for this nuclear dispute to be rumbling on behind it, you know, the context gives these announcements a much more worrying tone.
Yes, so just how dangerous a situation is this?
Well, look, the Iranians have basically put the onus on the Europeans to in some sense make up for the pressure that Iran is feeling from US economic sanctions. The reality is it's very hard for the Europeans to do that. There are various mechanisms they can try and use, but basically they cannot, compensate for the pressure or balance the pressure of economic sanctions, nor do they necessarily fully want to. So I think at the moment the trajectory of the nuclear deal is towards collapse, a slow collapse perhaps, if you look at the Iranian statements. But, you know, if Iran ultimately by the end of this month is physically in breach of the deal, that is going to be very difficult for the Europeans to accept. At that point, they will be encouraged by the Americans to basically call a halt and say that the deal is in effect over. So the pressures are ramping up on Iran economically, on European capitals diplomatically, and of course, as I say, this dangerous context in the Gulf itself, where there is a very real risk, either by accident or by design, of some kind of military action between Iran and the United States.
Jonathan Marcus, our diplomatic and defence correspondent. The founder of the Chinese tech giant Huawei has said the company will cut its production by $30 billion over the next 2 years in the face of US sanctions. Ren Zhongfei compared Huawei to a badly damaged aeroplane. A reporter in Shanghai is Robin Brandt, and I asked him whether Mr. Ren's company is heading for a crash.
He doesn't think they're going to crash, no. I mean, he thinks they are prepared for what will be a very significant impact on the company's ability to do business by the restrictions that President Trump's administration has put in place. They've been stockpiling for a year now. But look, the next 2 years are going to be very tricky for Huawei, and it's going to have a significant impact on the bottom line. I mean, 2018 was a very good year. They had record revenues of about $108 billion. Much of that came from rocketing sales of smartphones. They're now the world's number two smartphone manufacturer. But we're going to see a reversal of that trend overall. And Mr. Ren saying he thinks over the next 2 years there's going to be a $30 billion fall in revenue. So if you do the kind of back of the envelope calculations, they were forecasting $120 billion. I think that looks like a kind of a 12, 15% drop. But having said all of that, he thinks come 2021, there will be, quote, a rejuvenation.
Are the US sanctions against Huawei really about it spying for Beijing, or is Washington trying to disable a major competitor to American companies?
Well, firstly, obviously, those allegations of Huawei's close association with the Communist Party of China, the government here, are continually and robustly denied by the company, but President Trump's administration does believe that Huawei poses a national security threat to the United States because it believes it has very close associations with the party in government and comes under its influence. Is it about either of those two things? Well, it's actually about both. I mean, the US, although it continually fails to offer, you know, detailed empirical evidence, does believe Huawei poses a threat to national security, but it also sees China rising. It sees China with an industrial policy where it's trying to become dominant in strategic fields, aviation, electronic vehicle manufacturing, and also in the ability to manufacture its own microchips, microprocessors, and become dominant in that field. That is why, partly, President Trump's administration is choosing to target firms like Huawei, because it tries to prevent what some in China believe is an inevitable rise.
Robin Brandt speaking to me from Shanghai. Now to the latest investigation by the BBC's Africa Eye programme. Everyone in Uganda is entitled to free medicine to combat killer diseases like malaria. But despite government efforts to improve access to essential medicines, a significant number of people have to use private facilities because the drugs are often out of stock. The BBC's Africa Eye headed undercover to expose one of the reasons why there is a shortage of life-saving drugs, medicine theft, as Will Ross reports.
The rainy season means more mosquitoes and more malaria. On a visit to Kamuli town in eastern Uganda, Africa Eye's investigative journalist Solomon Sarwanja finds that at just one health centre, there are 30 malaria cases every day.
Make no mistake, malaria is still the number one cause of death in Uganda.
You know, as a parent, it's heartbreaking to see, you know, a son or daughter in pain.
Medicine is provided free by the Ugandan government, but only when it's in stock. When drugs run out, patients have to pay from their own pocket. Many parents simply can't afford malaria medicine for their children. Helen Musubika is an inventory officer at the clinic in Kamuli.
It's an expensive drug for these poor people here. They can't afford.
Patients die. Children die. I should admit they die.
But some children in other parts of the country are missing out because the drugs are being stolen, often by medical professionals. To find out how, Solomon Sarwanja works with two other colleagues who go undercover, posing as foreign businessmen wanting to buy stolen government drugs. They're easy to spot. They're stamped UG, Government of Uganda, not for sale.
So the 10, which I'm going to give you the 10 at 300 then.
Meet Richard Oraja, working at a private pharmacy in Kampala. Calculator in hand, Richard says he's ready to sell a large batch of a stolen anti-malarial called Lumartem. He says he does this often.
So now, 10 cartons would be how many dollars?
10 cartons will be, it is roughly 1,000.
Richard doesn't come up with the drugs, so our undercover reporters put that deal on hold for now and head north to the border town of Arua, where they meet Jamila Atim.
It has come to business.
The records officer at Arua Hospital is prepared to sell them any Ugandan government medicine they want, offering anti-malarials and 2,000 bottles of hepatitis B vaccines for starters.
In one bottle, it is a dose for 10 people. So we have 2,000. If they want 5,000, we send for 7,000.
Working with her crooked contacts, Jamila admits they simply inflate their order for the free government medicine so they can then sell on the surplus. This time she makes around $800 selling vaccines she says were meant for South Sudanese refugees living in northern Uganda. Sarah Opendi, Uganda's state minister for health, admits there's a problem.
It's sad that some people, not all really, we have very good health workers who are committed to their job and who want to serve the population. But we have a few rotten eggs that are actually doing this. And we need to get these rotten eggs out of the basket.
Let's go.
In Gulu, in northern Uganda, the team meets Patrick Kidega, a director of the Charity Medical Centre. He's also willing to do a dodgy deal.
In actual sense, this one, we are not supposed to sell it.
For $1,000, the undercover team buys 69 large boxes of anti-malarial drugs. But when they read the labels on the packs...
Deliver to the military operations. Bombo military.
It turns out more than half of this illegal consignment should be in Uganda's military stores. The team then stored all the stolen medicines at Solomon's home in Kampala with the intention of handing them back to the Ugandan government at the end of the investigation. The two undercover reporters then travel to meet up with Richard Oraja again, the pharmacist from earlier, who's now promised to deliver the drugs.
Oh, come on, pick up, pick up, pick up, pick up.
Hours later, Solomon's panicking as he can't reach them on the phone. It turns out they'd been arrested by the military intelligence and the whole team was then accused of dealing in stolen medicine. And it gets murkier. Both Patrick Kidega in Gulu and Jamila Atim in Arua have since disappeared, believed kidnapped. Patrick Kidega's worried family told the BBC he was abducted 4 months ago by a group of men, some of them allegedly wearing Ugandan army uniforms and carrying assault rifles. The Kampala pharmacist Richard Araja told us he'd never sold stolen Ugandan government medicine and denied he intended to sell us any UG anti-malarials. He says he acted as a whistleblower, alerting the National Drug Authority, or NDA, to our undercover team. We checked this claim with the NDA, who say while it's true he met agents briefly last year, Mr. Araja passed on information about different UG drugs being smuggled by unnamed people into the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda, which doesn't match the profile of our undercover team. As for the three Africa Eye journalists, they were released on bond. And even though Ugandan government officials have welcomed their efforts in helping to expose the rot, it's still not clear whether charges against them will be dropped.
Will Ross with that report. Still to come in this edition of our podcast.
We collect memories. These small things helps us to remind this time of a happy childhood.
We visit the hospital in Madrid that repairs children's toys and hear why people pass them on through the generations. The emergency services in Nigeria say at least 30 people have been killed in suicide attacks in the northeast of the country. 40 others are reported to have been wounded. Our correspondent, Maini Jones, sent this report from Lagos.
The attack happened in a hall where people were watching a football match on TV in Kondunga, an hour's drive southeast of the state's capital, Maiduguri. A local resident told the BBC that one of the bombers was prevented from entering the hall before detonating his vest. Two other attackers who were nearby then set off their devices. The attack is believed to have been carried out by the Boko Haram jihadist group, which has been operating in the region for a decade. Although it has lost territory to the Nigerian armed forces, the group still carries out regular attacks in the northeast.
Maini Jones reporting. An investigation by the BBC has found that young people in a city in northern England are being offered the equivalent of the UK's average weekly wage to stab each other by older gang leaders. Matthew Price reports.
Knife crime in Liverpool, as in other cities, is growing. Now another possible factor fueling that growth has emerged. Children said senior gang members are offering up to £1,000 to attack rivals in order to avoid punishment themselves. The teenagers, who wished to remain anonymous because they feared reprisals, spoke about one attack, which resulted in the victim being treated in hospital, in which they said a bounty had been offered.
It was like 15 kids who'd done it, yeah, and 2 kids split it. Put a grand on his head.
Like young kids getting money put on their heads and all that.
A former probation officer in Liverpool said bounties had been linked to gun crime, but he was now also hearing that they were being used in knife attacks. Last year, Merseyside police had one of the biggest increases in recorded knife offences. The force said it knew of crime groups exploiting young and vulnerable people to settle disputes by using violence.
Matthew Price. When land degrades and becomes less able to support the needs of the people living on it, trouble follows. And the UN Secretary-General, Antonio Guterres, has called for urgent global action to protect and restore degraded land. Professor Baron Joseph Orr is the lead scientist from the United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification. And Dan Damon asked him, is the challenge here to stop the spread of the world's deserts?
Well, it's not really a case of the desert spreading. It's a case of our impacts on the land becoming stronger and passing what that land can support in a natural way. And that is often talked about in the Sahara and the Sahel because the original understanding of this problem happened with the grazing that was taking place at that time in the 70s with the very serious droughts. But the problem actually is manifest in every country in the world, in every ecosystem type in the world.
There are ways to combat this. One of them is what's called the Great Green Wall, planting trees in the desert. That's not the only way.
Well, the Great Green Wall, the green and the tree part of it is what gets a lot of attention. But really what it amounts to is a strategy that combines what we do physically, planting trees and dealing with erosion, and the social side and the economic side. So trying to create value chains associated with what people are going to grow and harvest in those regions. If we can do that, we give them a livelihood, we give them a basis for securing the future of their children, and we are now in a position to bring greater security.
You must be an optimist. You wouldn't do the job you're doing if you weren't.
That's exactly right. I think that the challenges that we face are very large. There's no question about it. But on the other side of it, we have the capability to address them. For example, the technologies available to manage land sustainably, to restore or rehabilitate land, we're very, very good at that now. Where we're having a more difficult problem is dealing with the fact that land is transforming at a much faster rate than we're keeping up with because of growing food demands, growing energy demands. And that's really a different problem. We're now in the planning space. How do we optimize what we do across the landscape to meet multiple goals?
Professor Baron Joseph Orr from the UN Convention to Combat Desertification, speaking to Dan Damon. A group of South African teenagers have built their own plane, which has successfully completed its first flight. With the details, here's Parisa Kaban.
The plane was assembled from scratch by 20 teenagers in just 3 weeks. They all came from different backgrounds and got together to perfect the aircraft in a warehouse in Cape Town under the supervision of experts. This was done as part of a project called U-Dream, led by 17-year-old Megan Werner.
So people ask me, how did I come up with the idea? And I was actually supposed to be studying because I had my end year exam and I was writing biology the next day and I was trying so hard to study, but for some other reason, I just couldn't focus on my work. So eventually I went down to my parents and I told them about that I want to fly across Africa. They were like, okay, that's awesome, but it's already been done. So we came up with our few ideas and we eventually decided that we are going to build a plane with 20 teenagers and then fly it across Africa.
The four-seater sling plane, with imprints of Africa on its wings, was pieced together with thousands of individual components. The 20 students were chosen from 1,000 applicants. For many, it offered brand new experiences.
The most exciting moment for me was when, on the first day when I came there, so then I haven't like flown in an aeroplane or something, but then I flew for the very first time. That was the most exciting moment ever. That was the best experience, and the sun was setting, and then while we were flying, there was like a dam there, and then you could like see the sunset, but it was so amazing. It was very beautiful.
The young pilots are now on a mission to stop at several African countries before reaching Egypt.
Parisa Kaban reporting. The Toys Hospital is a unique shop found in the Spanish capital. It specialises in repairing old toys, some dating as far back as the 1930s, that have been passed down through families. Customers send them in from all corners of the country, hoping that the shop can restore them to their original condition, as Ashish Sharma reports.
It's like walking into an oversized cupboard full of toys. Tucked away in a quiet part of suburban Madrid is a Hospital de Juguetes. Here, toys are fixed for individuals, collectors, and even museums. Many are given to the shop so they can be repaired and then sold on. Antonio Martinez has owned the shop for the last 45 years, taking over from his parents who began making toys in 1945. He says as technology advanced, the ethos of his parents' business changed.
Everything changed in the 1950s when plastic arrived in Spain. There was a boom in toy making. My parents realized that they would have to make huge changes to their workshops, and this scared them. And that was the moment we moved from making toys to repairing them. And here we are today.
Eso? 70-year-old Marisol Brito is a typical customer. She lives in the north of Spain and spent over $100 for an old doll to be restored to give as a gift for a 14-year-old granddaughter, Violeta.
She wanted to give it to me as
as a present so I could see what kind of toys she played with when she was a child. My generation doesn't play with dolls at all, so it really helps me to understand how she used to play.
Interest in old toys has a resonance in Spain, so much so that the National Railway Museum of Madrid holds an old toys fair in the first week of every month. Well, I've just arrived at the Railway Museum here in Madrid, and I'm now joined by Luis González, who is the head of communications at the museum. Luis, thank you very much for making time.
Well,
this project was born back in 2014. We thought holding a fair would be interesting, as many of our old toys have now become part of Spain's heritage and culture. And it's popular. We have on average over 2,500 visitors on the day it is held.
Well, I'm just coming up to a really interesting store which has some really big cars and some very old toys, and Gloria is working behind it. Would you say that this is something that's much more of a male-dominated passion?
This is a world absolutely dominated by men. I think women see this like something old that you need to clean, or that always accumulate a lot of dust.
One customer explains that collecting old toys is a way to reconnect with his childhood.
I think that we collect memories. These small things helps us to remind this time of a happy childhood, and this is nice for me.
Back in the shop, and Antonio is tackling repairs for a doll made in the 1930s. It seems his Hospital de Juguetes is more than just a business. On one side, it's preserving a part of Spain's heritage. On the other, helping different generations connect with each other.
Ashish Sharma with that report from Madrid. And before we go, here's an update on a major World Service podcast investigating a murder mystery that dates back nearly 50 years.
An unidentified body in a remote Norwegian valley.
She was laying with her head down there.
Who was she? Fake passports, the wigs, the unprescripted glasses.
And what was she doing there?
She has an agenda and she doesn't want to talk about it.
I'm Marit Tegraf.
And I'm Neil McCarthy. And in Death in Ice Valley, we tried to find answers to a mystery that has remained unsolved for 48 years.
There are somebody living who knows more about this case.
Tracking down eyewitnesses and using new forensic technology.
Now I'm cutting the tooth.
Telling a story set deep in the Cold War with strong hints of espionage.
If you take the missile, I will shoot.
But it left us with a lingering feeling that someone didn't want the truth to be known.
Obviously, he was told by some people to keep his mouth shut.
We're about to come back with an update, so now's the perfect time to catch up with the whole series.
Why all this secrecy?
It was like a cover-up.
What on earth happened that day?
That's Death in Ice Valley from the BBC World Service and NRK.
I think we'll break this case right now.
Just search for Death in Ice Valley wherever you get your podcasts.
And that's all from us for now. But there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson, and until next time, goodbye.